We begin our third chapter tonight, The Purified Understanding. Remembering that Sri Aurobindo went through a process around 1932 where he began to revise the synthesis of yoga and to break it up into largely four parts. The first that we finished reading a few weeks ago was the Yoga of Divine Works. We're now into chapter three in the Yoga of Integral Knowledge, and after that the Yoga of Divine Love and the Yoga of Self-Perfection were to come and be broken in subsequent chapters. But of course, when they appeared in the Arya, it was a rolling number of articles, no clear divisions among the no definition that here we end the Yoga of Divine Works and now we begin the Yoga of Integral Knowledge. That all came upon his attempted revision. Attempted because he got into it and couldn't finish it, ran out of time. If you remember, his heaviest period of correspondence was between the years 1931 and 1937. The work that he was doing on the synthesis of yoga was in 1932, probably. The first two chapters that we've looked at in the Yoga of Integral Knowledge have been substantially revised. This third chapter was never touched again. And in fact, we'll go on to chapter 9, I think, which is about the release of the ego before he again takes it up and adds some reconsidered thoughts to the mixture. Clearly, he felt after 5 or 6 years of life in the ashram that there was some need, some appetite for guidance that he and the mother were not able to give to the disciples as they grew in number day to day. So the letters that Sri Aurobindo was writing in his correspondence were getting often read by many people in the ashram, not just the recipient, but they would be shared. A kind of divine post would be shared in the ashram courtyard with others. I think to give some sense of the nature of his work, to realize that he was trying to find the most effective channel through which he could guide, meant that the correspondence took precedence. None of this work that he did in the synthesis of yoga would see light until the late 40s. But the correspondence, at least, was read within the ashram, and then small books compiling selected letters that he carefully revised would appear to the public. The Riddle of This World, Lights on Yoga, Bases on Yoga, etc. So I thought I would read to you a rather lengthy letter that he wrote in January 1933 to Dilip Kumar Roy, in which he speaks pretty candidly about the nature of his work. I'll read the whole thing, although only some of it's directly relevant to this. And he says, "I am afraid I cannot endorse your reading of the situation, at least so far as the mother and myself and the prospects of the work are concerned. I can agree only that we have had a heavy time of it recently, and there has been a strong attack on the plane of the physical and material. But that, heavy attacks, is a thing we have been accustomed to for the last 30 years, and it has never prevented us from making any necessary advance. I have never had any illusions about the path being comfortable and easy. I knew all along that the work could only be done if all the essential difficulties rose and were faced, So their rising cannot tire or dishearten me, whatever obstinacy there may be in the difficulties, whether our own or in the sodics or in nature. About the correspondence, I would be indeed a brainless fool if I made it the central aim of my life to affect an absurd amount of letters and leave all higher aims aside. If I have given importance to the correspondence, it is because it was an effective instrument towards my central purpose. There are a large number of sodics whom it has helped to awake from lethargy and begin to tread the way of spiritual experience. Others, whom it has carried from a small round of experience to a flood of realizations, some who have been absolutely hopeless for years, who have undergone a conversion and entered from darkness into an opening of light. Others, no doubt, have not profited, or profited only a little. Also, there are some who wrote at random and wasted our time. But I think we can say that for the majority of those who wrote, there has been a real progress. No doubt also it was not the correspondence in itself, but the force that was increasing in its pressure on the physical nature, which was able to do all this. But a canalization was needed, and this served the purpose. There were many for whom it was not necessary, others for whom it was not suitable. If it had been a mere intellectual asking of questions, it would have been useless. But the substantial part was about sadhana and experience, and it was that that proved to be of great use. But as time went on, the correspondence began to grow too much and reached impossible proportions. Yet, it was difficult to stop the flood or to make distinctions which would not have been understood. So we have to seek a way out, and as yet have found only palliatives. The easy way would be if those who have opened would now rely mainly on the inner communication with only a necessary word now and then. Some have begun to do so. I suppose in the end, we shall be able to reduce the thing to manageable proportions. I do not see how the method of faith in the cells can be likened to eating a slice of the moon. Nobody ever got a slice of the moon, but the healing by faith in the cells is an actual fact and a law of nature and has been demonstrated often enough, even apart from yoga. The way to get faith and everything else is to insist on having them and refuse to flag or despair or give up until one has them. It is the way by which everything has been got since this difficult world began to have thinking and aspiring creatures upon it. It is to open always, always to the light and turn one's back on the darkness. It is to refuse the voices that say persistently, "You cannot, you shall not, you are incapable, you are the puppet of a dream." For these are the enemy voices. They cut one off from the result that was coming by their strident clamor, and then triumphantly point to the barrenness of the result as a proof of their thesis. The difficulty of the endeavor is a known thing, but the difficult is not the impossible. It is the difficult that has always been accomplished, and the conquest of difficulties makes up all that is valuable in the earth's history. In the spiritual endeavor also it shall be so. No, I am not tired or on the point of giving up. I have made inwardly steps in front in the last 2 or 3 months, which had seemed impossible because of the obstinate resistance for years together, and it is not an experience which pushes me to despair and give up. If there is much resistance on one side, there have been large gains on the other. All has not been a picture of sterile darkness. You yourself are kept back only by the demon of doubt, which bangs on you each door as you are opening. You have only to set about resolutely slaying the Rakshasa, and the doors will open to you as they have done to many others who were held up by their own mind or vital nature. A lengthy letter, but it shows you that even there, in the early years of the ashram, when everybody had come crashing down out of the grand, the glorious, the golden period of the ashram, when everyone was having wonderful experiences and the Godheads were trying to manifest throughout all the human population there, and they reached the physical and everything seemed to grind to a halt, that Sri Aurobindo continued to advance, sedulously to move forward without despair, and answering patiently the questions that came to him. All the petitioners were still there as he turned to the synthesis of yoga and began to revise. Well, he never got to finish the revision of the synthesis. Only the first part, the yoga of divine works, was ready when he left his body. But he has touched some of the rest, and even if he never looked at it again, it is still a glowing testament of how we might synthetically approach fusing the divine consciousness into the material in the presence of our own being, that we can be those agents, we can be the prospect of canalization that he refers to in this letter. So, this chapter, unrevised, saw publication on 15 February 1916, so well over 100 years ago. We'll go through it now. Chapter 3, Purified Understanding. The description of the status of knowledge to which we aspire determines the means of knowledge which we shall use. That status of knowledge may be summed up as a supramental realization which is prepared by mental representations through various mental principles in us, and once attained, again reflects itself more perfectly in all the members of the being. So if the object of knowledge is the knowledge of the integral divine, transcendent, universal, and stationed in each individual, and the status of knowledge is to not find sufficient release into the self as an abstract silence, but into its dynamic enginery in the universe, entering into that in all the principles of the being, then the status must become supramental for it to be perfect. It is a re-seeing and therefore a remolding of our whole existence in the light of the divine and one and eternal, free from subjection to the appearances of things and the externalities of our superficial being. So again, because one achieves that supramental level, sight and action, consciousness and power become one again, a true, pure, harmonious expression of the nature of Satchit Ananda. Such a passage from the human to the divine, from the divided and discordant to the one, from the phenomenon of the eternal truth, such an entire rebirth or new birth of the soul must necessarily involve two stages, one of preparation, in which the soul and its instruments must become fit, and another of actual illumination and realization, in the prepared soul through its fit instruments. There is indeed no rigid line of demarcation in sequence of time between these two stages. Rather, they are necessary to each other and continue simultaneously. For in proportion as the soul becomes fit, it increases in illumination and rises to higher and higher, completer and completer realizations. And in proportion as these illuminations and these realizations increase, becomes fit and its instruments more adequate to their task. There are soul seasons of unillumined preparation and soul seasons of illumined growth and culminating soul moments, more or less prolonged, of illumined possession, moments that are transient like the flash of the lightning, yet change the whole spiritual future. Moments also that extend over many human hours, days, weeks, in a constant light or blaze of the sun of truth. And this, too, is a reflection in a paragraph of 10 years of his sadhana. How he has come to use each suffusion of divine light to further massage into the tissues of his being, mental, emotional, physical, and how those becoming more capacious, more capable of holding power and light, then invite a further descent from above. So this is a divine conversation which is going on between the soul and nature, inviting the divine from above into it. So individual, cosmos, and transcendent are becoming one in this process. And through all these, the soul, once turned Godwards, grows towards the permanence and perfection of its new birth and real existence. So this is the real coming into the apparent ignorance of our current nature, the real Sat. The first necessity of preparation is the purifying of all the members of our being. So he's talked about the object, he's talked about the status of what we shall achieve, and now he's getting into the how-to. This is the technique. And the first step is purification. If you look at Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, you find that purification, attaining the state of purity, shuchi, is among the first elements involved in the yamas and niyamas. Elementary, these are not the farther steps, but these are the first steps. And what does Patanjali refer to in terms of philosophic expression, but of course, the Sankhya system. So you expect to meet very shortly more terms from the Sankhya philosophy. The first necessity of preparation is the purifying of all the members of our being. Especially for the path of knowledge, the purification of the understanding, the key that shall open the door of truth. And a purified understanding is hardly possible without the purification of the other members, because there's the gravid nature that pulls everything downwards, so the mind doesn't get to rest in its own province. It's most often in active interface with physicality and with vitality. An unpurified heart, an unpurified sense, an unpurified life confuse the understanding, disturb its data, distort its conclusions, darken its seeing, misapply its knowledge. An unpurified physical system clogs or chokes up its action. There must be an integral purity. Here also, there is an interdependence. Well, if integral refers to the integer, to one, that means all the elements have been combined into one compass and recognize each other, and yet, as he says, there is an interdependence. Becoming one doesn't mean everything gets washed out into homogeneity. For the purification of each member of our being profits by the clarifying of every other. The progressive tranquilization of the emotional heart, helping, for instance, the purification of the understanding, while equally a purified understanding imposes calm and light on the turbid and darkened workings of the yet impure emotions. It may even be said that while each member of our being has its own proper principles of purification, yet it is the purified understanding that in man is the most potent cleanser of his turbid and disordered being and most sovereignly imposes their right working on his other members. Now again, this is part of his personal experience. Because he was able to throw himself by grace, by personal effort, into a felt oneness in which there was the extinction of ego and only Brahman was real, he could bring that purity back into all of his experiences and use it as a lustrous element in the progress of his yoga. Knowledge, says the Gita, is the sovereign purity. And that's Bhagavad Gita, chapter 4, shloka 38. Light is the source of all clearness and harmony, even as the darkness of ignorance is the cause of our stumblings. Love, for example, is the purifier of the heart. And by reducing all our emotions into terms of divine love, the heart is perfected and fulfilled. Yet, love itself needs to be clarified by divine knowledge. The heart's love of God may be blind, narrow, and ignorant, and lead to fanaticism and obscurantism. It may, even when otherwise pure, limit our perfection by refusing to see him, except in a limited personality, and by recoiling from the true and infinite vision. The heart's love of man may equally lead to distortions and exaggerations in feeling, action, and knowledge, which have to be corrected and prevented by the purification of the understanding. Well, we see how in the Gita we begin with an insistence on works, on illumined works. Then comes knowledge, and finally comes love as the crown, as the epitome. But not love first, because it could turn sentimental, it could be weak. So even in the Yoga of the Gita, which Sri Aurobindo often follows in his depiction of the stages of advance in the integral yoga, there is this movement. Always yoga has to be founded upon action, because we must embrace the world, not reject it. Always it must attain a unity in vision, a unity in identity of soul with nature and with God. And because you work, because you consecrate, because you become one with what you offer, because you know by identity that which you seek, then you come to love. And there is no sentimentality. There is no moribund nature to the emotion. Everything is uplifted. It is felicity and beauty expressed in harmonic action, seeing the one whom you know everywhere. All that you do is done from that state of yoga, of oneness. We must, however, consider deeply and clearly what we mean by the understanding and its purification. We use the word as the nearest equivalent we can get in the English tongue to the Sanskrit philosophical term buddhi. Therefore, we exclude from it the action of the sense mind, which merely consists of the recording of perceptions of all kinds without distinction, whether they be right or wrong, true or mere illusory phenomena, penetrating or superficial. So here we come back to Sankhya. So at the height of the Sankhyan scheme is the great, the mahas, or buddhi. Buddhi, a word that means illumination. Hence, Buddha, the enlightened one, right? Differentiated immediately from the action of the sense mind. That would be manas. So, if we looked from above, there would be this high station in nature, which is illuminated. It is really illuminated by the power, the glow of the real person who stands back from it all. But buddhi is most capable of catching and reflecting that. So it suggests a kind of dualism which Sri Aurobindo doesn't really accept, but the language is inevitable because all of Indian philosophy uses Sankhyan terminology, so we have to use it. So buddhi above, manas below, gathering all the information from the senses, whether we experience something with the physical senses, sight, taste, touch, etc., and pull it together and assemble it and pass it on, it is manas that receives all this sensory data. If we have emotional experiences, if we begin to think about how we want to coordinate these emotional and physical experiences, this too is the work of manas. This too comes back to manas to organize, to depict. So, and now he continues to describe basically the action of this level of the mind, not the buddhi, not the higher range, which we would say is intellection, ratiocination at its highest, but this is the action of the sense mind. Receiving data from below, organizing it into little piles, and then passing it on to buddhi for examination. We exclude, he continues, that mass confused conception which is merely a rendering of these perceptions and is equally void of the higher principle of judgment and discrimination. So what the manas does is describe, compiles and describe. What the buddhi does, by suggestion, is analysis, is discrimination. Nor can we include that constant leaping current of habitual thought which does duty for understanding in the mind of the average unthinking man, but is only a constant repetition of habitual associations, desires, prejudices, prejudgments, received or inherited preferences, even though it may constantly enrich itself by a fresh stock of concepts streaming in from the environment and admitted without the challenge of the sovereign discriminating reason. So this is material coming to us unfiltered by the buddhi, but still reaching the threshold of examination of the sense mind. These are sanskaras, etc. All of it in a vast reservoir, the vasanas, which can be held for future examination should we wish, but which can also sit there unused, but silently influencing the nature, the experience of the manas, which then passes along its experience to the buddhi for examination. So you can see how partiality passes its own wrong perspective up the scale and influences even our best judgment. Ah, a warning. Undoubtedly, this is a sort of understanding which has been very useful in the development of man from the animal, but it is only one remove above the animal mind. It is a half-animal reason subservient to habit, to desire, and the senses, and is of no avail in the search, whether for scientific or philosophical or spiritual knowledge. We have to go beyond it. Its purification can only be effected either by dismissing it or silencing it altogether, or by transmuting it into the true understanding. So we must go beyond the half-animal mind. We must reach into full mentality, because this is a kind of half-mentalized state. I should say, in defense of the animal mind, that Sri Aurobindo has a rather fond regard and does not say that animals are absent consciousness, and says that they even have the capacity for reasoning within them, and he cites examples from his ownership of pets to illustrate. So this wide chasm between the animal and the human is something Sri Aurobindo dispenses with. There is a range of difference, but we exaggerate. By the understanding, we mean that which it once perceives, judges, and discriminates, the true reason of the human being, not subservient to the senses, to desire, or to the blind force of habit, but working in its own right for mastery, for knowledge. Certainly, the reason of man, as he is at present, does not even at its best act entirely in this free and sovereign fashion. But so far as it fails because it is still mixed with the lower half-animal action, because it is impure and constantly hampered and pulled down from its characteristic action. In its purity, it should not be involved in these lower movements, but stand back from the object and observe disinterestedly, put it in its right place in the whole, by force of comparison, contrast, analogy, reason from its rightly observed data by deduction, induction, inference, and holding all its gains in memory and supplementing them by a chastened and rightly guided imagination, view all in the light of a trained and disciplined judgment. So this is a movement towards the positioning of the consciousness in the Purusha, so that one can be distinct from Prakriti. It isn't there, but it's a movement back in toward the inwardness of the mind, which allows it to act more from its own sovereignty. Note all these functions here of reason, which are noted in Indian philosophy, and which are given some value in the lower hemisphere, but which do not reflect the great knowledge, which is the goal of the yogin, which is the goal of the philosopher, which would be jnana, the spiritual, essential knowledge of the self beyond all these permutations in time. That is the sought-after goal of Jnana Yoga. Such is the pure intellectual understanding of which disinterested observation, judgment, and reasoning are the law and characterizing action. So this would be the well-balanced rational intellect. This would be part of the action of the Manomaya Purusha. But the term buddhi is also used in another and profounder sense. The intellectual understanding is only the lower buddhi. There is another and a higher buddhi, which is not intelligence, but vision, is not understanding, but rather an overstanding in knowledge, and does not seek knowledge and attain it in subjection to the data it observes, but possesses already the truth and brings it out in the terms of a revelatory and intuitional thought. There's a footnote here. The divine being is described as Adhyaksha, he who, seated overall in the supreme ether, oversees things, views, and controls them from above. It means literally an eye above. Above what? This triple universe. So this distinction is that bridge whereby one departs from slavery to the natural formations of prakriti and hews to the self-born light from within, Swayambhu, to go back to the Upanishad. The nearest the human mind gets to this truth-conscious knowledge is that imperfect action of illumined finding which occurs when there is a great stress of thought and the intellect, electrified by constant discharges from behind the veil and yielding to a higher enthusiasm, admits a considerable in-streaming from the intuitive inspired faculty of knowledge. So Sri Aurobindo is here, again referring to his own experience. This is consonant with how he rose into a deeper, a more intuitive understanding of what was the vision of the Vedic Rishi. This, he describes here, is a Vedic experience. Electrified, vidyut, by constant discharges from behind the veil, yielding to a higher enthusiasm. Again, he's a Greek scholar, so to him, enthusiasm, enthusiasmos, means God-inspired energy. So this is a bolt of lightning from above, streaming into him from ranges of inspiration above. This is that river of inspiration, Saraswati, which is supramental in its origin, intuitive in its immediate capacity as we receive it here in what is receptive in our intellects. But the beauty of this language confers to us how the ordinary mind is overwhelmed and awed when confronted with this revelatory power of light. The term buddhi is suggestive, but remember the other term that the Sankhya uses, mahas, what is vast, what is great, because it is a vast light that wants to come crowding into these cramped rooms of the mind, and they feel that pressure and respond as best they can, the finite opening to the infinite. For there is an intuitive mind in man which serves as a recipient and channel for these in-streamings from a supramental faculty. But the action of intuition and inspiration in us is imperfect in kind, as well as intermittent in action. Ordinarily, it comes in response to a claim from the laboring and struggling heart or intellect, and even before its givings enter the conscious mind, they are already affected by the thought or aspiration which went up to meet them, are no longer pure, but altered to the needs of the heart or intellect. And after they enter the conscious mind, they are immediately seized upon by the intellectual understanding and dissipated or broken up so as to fit in with our imperfect intellectual knowledge, or by the heart, and remolded to suit our blind or half-blind emotional longings and preferences, or even by the lower cravings, and distorted to the vehement uses of our hungers and passions. So we can see that he's he's not unfamiliar with the masala that we get when we bring the higher lights into our lower nature, and everything gets mixed up. We get a mixture, and we manage to dumb down the great illumination to something that is assimilable to our mind. But fortunately, as we are overwashed by this light, it does slightly improve us, and we do get better, and we become more capacious, and we rise up grade by grade, just as he was suggesting in that letter that he wrote to Dilip Kumar Roy. If this higher buddhi could act pure of the interference of these lower members, it would give pure forms of the truth. Observation would be dominated or replaced by a vision which could see without subservient dependence on the testimony of the sense mind and senses. He suggests here that one can reach out and see with an apprehending consciousness, which he's characterized as one of the stages of the supranatural vision, without the intercession of senses or mind. The consciousness wills to know, it reaches out and attains its object. Imagination would give place to the self-assured inspiration of the truth. Again, imagination is the means by which inspiration works. Reasoning to the spontaneous discernment of relations and conclusion from reasoning to an intuition containing in itself those relations and not building laboriously upon them, the spontaneity of sight. Judgment to a thought vision in whose light the truth would stand revealed without the mask which it now wears and which our intellectual judgment has to penetrate. While memory, too, would take upon itself that larger sense given to it in Greek thought and be no longer a paltry selection from the store gained by the individual in his present life, but rather the all-recording knowledge which secretly holds and constantly gives from itself everything that we now seem painfully to acquire, but really, in this sense, remember, a knowledge which includes the future no less than the past. In this sense, the power of prophecy has been aptly called the memory of the future in his note. Rather theosophical, that. Certainly, we are intended to grow in our receptivity to this higher faculty of truth-conscious knowledge, but its full and unveiled use is as yet the privilege of the gods and beyond our present human stature. So I think that's a great place to put our bookmark. We'll finish the chapter probably next week. So let's turn to savitri. Again, early in book one, the book of beginnings, Let's look in Canto 3, The Yoga of the Soul's Release, at a passage that begins on page 26. As so he grew into his larger self, humanity framed his movements less and less. A greater being saw a greater world. A fearless will for knowledge dared to erase the lines of safety reason draws that bar minds soar, souls dive into the infinite. Even his first steps broke our small earth bounds and loitered in a vaster, freer air. In hands sustained by a transfiguring might, he caught up lightly like a giant's bow, left slumbering in a sealed and secret cave, the powers that sleep unused in man within. He made of miracle a normal act, and turned to a common part of divine works, magnificently natural at this height, efforts that would shatter the strength of mortal hearts, pursued in a royalty of mighty ease, aims too sublime for nature's daily will. The gifts of the Spirit crowding came to him. They were his life's pattern and his privilege. A pure perception lent its lucent joy. Its intimate vision waited not to think. It enveloped all nature in a single glance. It looked into the very self of things. Deceived no more by form, he saw the soul. In beings, it knew what lurked to them unknown. It seized the idea in mind, the wish in the heart. It plucked out from gray folds of secrecy the motives which from their own sight men hide. He felt the beating life in other men invade him with their happiness and their grief, their love, their anger, their unspoken hopes entered in currents or in pouring waves into the immobile ocean of his calm. He heard the inspired sound of his own thoughts re-echoed in the vault of other minds. The world's thought streams traveled into his ken. His inner self grew near to others' selves and bore a kinship's weight, a common tie, yet stood untouched, king of itself, alone. A magical accord quickened and attuned to ethereal symphonies, the old earthy strings. It raised the servitors of mind and life to be happy partners in the soul's response. Tissue and nerve were turned to sensitive chords, records of luster and ecstasy. It made the body's means the spirit's acolytes. A heavenlier function with a finer mode, lit with its grace man's outward earthliness. The soul's experience of its deeper sheaths no more slept drugged by matter's dominance. In the dead wall closing us from wider self, into a secrecy of apparent sleep, the mystic tract beyond our waking thoughts, a door parted, built in by matter's trance. Releasing things unseized by earthly sense. A world unseen, unknown by outward mind, appeared in the silent spaces of the soul. He sat in secret chambers looking out into the luminous countries of the unborn, where all things dreamed by the mind are seen and true. And all that the life longs for is drawn close. Jai Ma. Namaste.